We got some great stories lined up for you guys today, but first, let me talk to you about a company who's making it possible, Red Bobber. Their tagline is "Reel in those precious memories." They're a lifestyle brand, and when you see their logo, that red bobber, a little hint of nostalgia comes back to those early days when you were fishing out there with just a bobber and a hook and making memories out there with your family. For the listeners, they're giving a discount code for 20% off your order. The promo code is HAP. You can find them at redbobbergear.com. Y'all go check them out.
We finally got on this pretty good gator. He's about 5 foot long. And we get this alligator, get him back home, and we're always messing with my dad, trying to get a row out of him. So we sneak into their bedroom with this 5 foot alligator, and we go into their bathroom. And we thought this was going to be so funny. You know, I'm going to put this alligator in the bathtub, you know, and dad's going to get up in the middle of the night. He's going to go in there and he's going to see this alligator. It's going to be hilarious.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Hayden, Alabama podcast, where we're Southern storytellers. I'm Philip.
I'm Robin.
I'm Gator.
I'm David.
I'm Jimmy.
You know a podcast is going to be good when you got a guy named Gator. It's got to be good. I mean, we're not trying to put you on a pedestal or anything, but or set the false hopes. But we're here today in Oyster Bay Baptist Church. We're in the fellowship hall so the stories can have a little more leeway, you know. There's a difference between when you tell a story in sanctuary. But we have a men's event tonight, but we thought this would be a great time to seize an opportunity to get some stories from down around Gulf Shores, Mobile area. So that's what y'all are in store for. We're going to have a wide variety, but y'all just sit back and get ready to listen to some stories. Mr. Nelson, you said that you were going to lead us off, so take it away.
I start off with one from Gator. Several years ago, Gator was over at the boatyard working, and we got a phone call that somebody had caught an alligator and taped its mouth up and had him over here loose in the road. They'd call the conservation department and everything, and so anyway, they called Gator. David's daddy was preacher then, so they called Gator to come take a look at it. So Gator come over here, and he's like, ain't no big deal. So him and a buddy of his gets the alligator, you know, and they're going to take it down to the house and turn him loose. Well, this time, the conservation department calls Gator up, and he's just giving him what for. He says, you know this ain't no Crocodile Dundee thing. This is real McCoy. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so Gator said, well, my name's Gator Nelson. You ought to have a little bit of, you know, realize that I've done this before. And Gator, anyway, they turned him loose, and everybody was fine, and the tree huggers were fine with him too.
We didn't get in too much trouble, thank goodness.
That's what I want to know. You said everything was fine, but clearly that was a turbulent situation for a few minutes. I mean, how did it unfold so that you didn't go to jail?
Well, there's really two parts to that story, because about a week later, we got the alligator back in the water and everything, but apparently somebody had caught the alligator again and taped his mouth shut, and he was out here in front of the church.
David was naive, and so David and Gator come over here. Well, David's like, well, how are we going to catch this alligator? And Gator tells David, well, just jump on him. And so dummy here jumps on the alligator and wrestles him down, and Gator's about to die laughing, you know, like, have you lost your mind? What are you doing jumping on this alligator? Anyway, so David wrestles him down, you know, and so then they tie him up, and then that's when they towed him to the river, you know, and turn him loose. And, of course, genius here had wrestled the alligator.
But before he wrestled this alligator and he got him down to the ground, and David goes, what do you mean to do now? And I said, well, turn him loose and let's just drag him up. And he's like, turn him loose. I done wrestled this thing down to the ground for 20 minutes.
Man, that's crazy. I don't know what all stories you're going to tell, but we went fishing yesterday. I was going to say we went red fishing. We went trout fishing yesterday.
We were supposed to go red fishing.
It was awesome. Best day on the water I ever had. You told a story about another alligator, and I don't want to leave. If you can tell that story, you remember sharing it?
Yeah.
Can you tell that one while we're in the alligator vein?
So David and I, we were probably 14 at the time. We decided we were going to go out one night. We're going to do some alligator hunting, catch some alligators. We caught some small ones and whatnot. And we finally got on this pretty good gator. He was about 5 foot long. And we get this alligator, get him back home, and we're always messing with my dad, trying to get a row out of him. So we sneak into their bedroom with this 5 foot alligator, and we go into their bathroom. And we thought this was going to be so funny. You know, I'm going to put this alligator in the bathtub, you know, and dad's going to get up in the middle of the night. He's going to go in there and he's going to see this alligator. It's going to be hilarious. So we put this alligator in the bathtub, and in my parents' bathroom, the toilet's kind of in the center here.
I got to ask a question. How do you sneak in a house with an alligator?
Well,
very carefully.
And luckily, my dad snored pretty loud at the time, so it wasn't too hard. But yeah, it was. I had the head, David had the tail, and we were sneaking in there pretty quiet. But we get into this bathroom. Like I said, the bathtub's just to the left of the toilet. So this alligator's in there, and we're giggling and laughing. This is going to be the funniest thing ever when Dad comes in there to use the bathroom. So we go upstairs, and we're hanging out. We're waiting to hear, and nothing happens. So we finally just, you know, we call it a night. Well, about 3 o'clock in the morning, my mom beats my dad to the bathroom. And she goes in there, sits down, and to the left, she said she saw this head raise up over the edge of the bathtub. And he opened his mouth and said, "Ha!" All we heard was screaming and hollering. And David and Gator, you better get down here right now. I'm going to beat y'all to death. And to this day, if you bring up that story, my mom will get fire and mad about it. So
I don't blame her. Ain't nothing like sitting on a pot and seeing an alligator look at you.
Well, it wasn't meant for her. You know, we were trying to get Dad, but she was innocent.
Intention really don't matter at that point in time.
That's right.
Well, go show you what kind of upbringing these kids had. You know, yeah. They started out at 8 or 9 years old catching alligators, and that's all they ever done. One more alligator story.
Wait a minute. We can't just blast past that. I've got to go inside the house. So your mom is wailing and gnashing of teeth. She's yelling all your names, the names you were given and the names that you haven't been given yet. What is Dad doing?
Nothing.
Oh, he thought,
no big
yeah,
deal.
He was one of the guys that night. He thought it was funny too.
So you didn't get mad at Gator or nothing?
Why?
I don't know. I'm thinking I would have been mad if I woke up and an alligator. Did you tape his mouth at least?
This is a different world we live in.
We left him open.
Yeah. Are you serious? So he could have bit her?
We didn't. Mom never got up. You know, it was always Dad.
But he could have bit your dad.
I mean, it wasn't 4 or 5 foot long. It wasn't a big gator.
The man just had a alligator in his bathtub, and his wife was exposed to a healthy, big alligator. And he said, "Why you get mad?"
Those weren't the only gators that had ever made it into the bathtub either. No. You know, I mean, it was we had done it several times.
We'd worked
times.
Our way up to a 5 or 6 footer. I mean, it was babies where you can catch them with one hand. And then we gradually got to where we felt a little brave. And I'm pretty sure Jimmy had probably done similar things when he was our age.
This is a genetic thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
It's a trait that was passed down to generations, yeah.
And another one, Gator caught a little 2 foot, 3 foot gator one night, and he brings him up there. And he wakes his mother up with him about 2 inches from her nose, you know. "Mom, look what I caught." That's another night you like to get killed. And he always put him in his, teased his sister with him, put him in her bathtub. But we had a buddy of ours. We had a camp up above Mobile. And we had this young, it was 3 grown men, 2 other guys. But anyway, we had this young boy, he was about 15, had moved it down here from up north. Anyway, he was petrified of alligators. I mean, just scared to death of them. And his name was Arvid. Well, we caught Arvid gone, so we caught this 2.5-3 foot alligator. We put it in a sleeping bag and zipped it up. Well, Arvid was real bashful, timid, you know. So anyway, we cooked supper and we was messing around. The alligator just laid in the bed, you know. He didn't move or anything. So anyway, after we got through eating, we noticed Arv was slipping around wanting to go to bed. So we got busy, and all of a sudden we heard hollering and screaming and some words we can't say. But anyway, Arvid had got in the bed with the alligator, and he tore the bed back open, screaming at us, telling what sorry, no account fellas we are. And he liked to have a heart attack. Anyway, throw the alligator out of the bed, and he never did come back to the camp. I don't know why. I mean,
see, that's where I got it from, Philip. See?
All I know is that you had extended a very kind invitation that sometime later on we could go to the camp, and I told you that I would be there, but I'm rethinking that every second now.
Just don't jump in the bed quick, you know?
Evaluate everything. Covers back. Evaluate everything is what I'm hearing.
We have rattlesnakes at this camp.
Are you in trouble? Well, we hope you're not, but just in case you are, we know a good lawyer. Whitney Island here in Hayden, Alabama has law services. Or maybe if you're not from Hayden, I'm sure she'd be happy to hear from you. So check her out at islandlaw.com. We appreciate Whitney and her sponsoring the show. Robin, why don't you tell us one real quick?
Well, mine has is a story about another demographic group of people. We call them Cajuns. When I was in seminary, my wife and I somehow or another got tickets to an LSU football game. They're playing Mississippi State. And we went there with our daughter, who was 3 at the time, and she's 35 now. So this was a while back. And the tickets were given to us, so we couldn't complain, but we were in the nosebleed section of the stadium. It was on October night, and it started to rain, and my daughter had a little Barney the Dinosaur umbrella. And I had made friends with those Cajuns sitting around me. I was carrying on. My wife was giving them a hard time about how we were going to beat them. And I said, I'm pulling for LSU. And anyway, a good banner, good natured humor. We were all getting along. It started to rain, and I said, look, guys, I'm going to put this little umbrella up. They have a rule, no umbrellas in the stadium. And they stick to that. You're going to see it in a minute. But I said, guys, I'm going to put this little umbrella up for my daughter. And they said, and I quote, don't let that baby get wet. And there are a bunch of, we'll say, encouraged Cajuns up there. And the usher comes up there and says, y'all have to close the umbrella. And they said, don't let that baby get wet. They got them a bunch of drunk Cajuns up there and backed the usher down. And I'm real nervous at this point. I said, fellas, you know, they'll take us to jail. And so he went and got a group of ushers and one security guard. They went and got other Boudreaux and all those Cajuns from Thibodeau and White Castle and all the places that Cajuns are from. They backed that group of folks down. And then one of those Cajuns got up there behind us and opened a OSHA-approved base jumping parachute of an umbrella open over that baby. And that baby ain't going to get wet. And by this time, I'm having a fit. I'm about to have a nervous crackdown. Look, guys, they're going to take us to jail. You have to follow the rules. It's a social norm. That baby ain't going to get wet. And all this time, they're recruiting more Cajuns. I see the Louisiana State Police coming up here with a riot team, batons, M16s, AK-47s, and sawed-off shotguns, and they are recruiting other Cajuns. The only thing that saved a riot was it quit raining. They shut that umbrella. My little girl was on a picture of the Baton Rouge paper the next day, front page, holding her little Barney umbrella under that parachute umbrella, and said, I forgot what the headlines was. It was something about, did you get wet last night?
Robin, you get in the craziest messes that I've ever heard. It's just, it's like he's a magnet for story-worthy situations. I love that. Who won the game?
LSU had a big tight end, LaFleur, LeBlanc, something. He's about 6'8". Mississippi State ain't covered him yet. He caught 19 passes in the first quarter. Hey, it'd be a bunch to not very many, about 38-6 or something like that.
Well, let's take it back over to the other table. One of y'all lead away. David, you've been quiet for a preacher.
I've been kind of soaking it all in and reminiscing. And as Robin is talking about Cajun culture, I think that's kind of a similar culture to what we have down here in deep, deep South Alabama and in Bon Secours. And that's probably why we were so apt to get in trouble. And so I've been running with Gators since I was probably in elementary school. And so when I was in my late teens, I started working over at the boatyard. Jimmy was still in charge over there at that point. Me and Gator were both working there. And you want to talk about like the hardest work you could ever do in July. I mean, it's 115 degrees and 110% humidity, and it's awful. Well, as the low guy on the totem pole, my responsibility was to do strictly bottom jobs on shrimp boats, fishing boats, all those things. So kind of the progression of that, you haul a boat up, you pressure wash it off with a pressure washer. So step one, in the heat, you're covered in the stinkiest river mud you've ever seen in your life. Once you pressure wash it, then you get a scraper and you start scraping barnacles off the bottom of it. So you covered in river mud, then you get covered in barnacle guts. And then you go through and sand it, and then eventually you put this thick coat of copper bottom paint on it. And, I mean, it's really, really thick. And so I've been there for probably a week or two and figuring it out and learning how to do stuff. And I get done painting this boat, and the guy who worked with me, Tommy Ewan. Well,
and hang on.
Rest his soul.
This is before the, the low fume paints. And this was in the toxic era where,
yep.
I mean, you could smell it a mile away.
Yep.
This was real deal stuff. EPA would not approve nowadays.
It was the stuff that worked well.
It worked well.
Yep. Yeah.
That's the reason these two ain't too smart.
So, yeah. And that's where I'm going with this. So I get there and I slather this paint on this boat, and I mean, it takes hours to do it, and you're covered in it. You got red or blue or whatever color it is all over you, and you got to scrub yourself with paint thinner. Like, it's probably not very safe to douse your entire body in paint thinner either. But Tommy Ewan, who I was working with, he said, man, you look tired. You need to take a break. Here, sit down on this 5-gallon bucket right here and take a 30-minute break. Well, he sat me right up underneath this boat that I just got done painting that had the most ridiculous fumes ever. So in about 10 minutes, I was high as a kite. I couldn't walk straight. I couldn't go to the bathroom. So it was pretty much that on a daily basis. And Tommy was a big dude. He's probably what, 6'3", 6'4",
yeah,
over 300 pounds. I mean, a big beard, hairy guy. So one of the first experiences I had with him, he said, we got to knock this propeller off this boat. And I'm probably 14, 15 years old, and I'm 165 pounds soaking wet. I said, all right, well, how are we going to do it? He said, you're going to stand right there and hold this big metal bit up and turn your head, and I'm going to hit it with this 20-pound sledgehammer. And he said, do not move. If you move, I'm going to break both of your arms with this sledgehammer.
Tommy looked like Thor with his hammer.
redneck boatyard Thor, and I've never been so terrified in my entire life. And I stood there and held that bit. Next thing I know, ping, and that prop goes flying off the back of that boat. So those are the kind of boatyard lessons you learn.
You think that crafted you and kind of made you a hard worker and appreciative?
Absolutely.
Of hard work?
And I've told people that often, because I coached football for 20 years. And guys would be dragging in to dinner after practice and talk about how miserable it was. I was like, y'all don't even know what miserable is until you get out there doing that in 110 degrees every day of the week, covered in all that stuff. Like, it did. It galvanized a work ethic in me that I'm thankful for, and I got to build a relationship with them. So
I think Gator has moved beyond that. I feel like he's living a life now that he's really good. You know, he's appreciating the hard work that he's gone through, and he's embodied.
Have you lost your mind?
Well, I never was addicted to paint, paint thinner and paint fumes. You know, that's the biggest thing.
You were able to move away from
it. I was able to put that
no
aside.
No withdrawals.
It was funny watching him stumble across the yard there for about 30 minutes, though.
Man, I tell you, you got to be – fumes are real.
I got another good boatyard story.
Come on.
And this is one – So I learned how to work. I also learned what toughness looked like. So Tommy had a brother named Chris, and we all worked together on the yard. And one day, Chris was prying a wood plank off the side of a, I guess it was a shrimp boat or some type of wooden boat.
Old shrimp boat.
But so he's prying this plank off this boat and has like a pry bar up there, and the plank comes back and it jabs a big old nail right through his forearm.
A ring shank nail.
It was in there. It's a monster. And you can see the head of the nail on this side and a good bit of the nail poking out the other side. So he comes walking up there all nonchalant to, hey, I need to go to the doctor, man. I got this. And I'd never seen anything like it in my life. Like, I'm about to throw up. I don't know what to do. So we load him in the truck, start taking him towards Gulf Shores to take him to the doctor. And I'm thinking this is pretty urgent. He's like, hey, pull over right there in the Delta Mart. That was the old Shell station when you used to come over the bridge. He said, pull over at the Delta Mart. I need to get me Hawaiian Punch before we go to the doctor. Walks in the gas station, buys him Hawaiian Punch, nonchalantly comes back, starts drinking his drink, and then get him to the doctor. And the doctor essentially asked Gator to hold his arm down while he takes some pliers.
But before he got out, I'm go running in there and turn around, and Chris is like, hey, man, I think your left tire is a little low back here. I'm like, the heck with the tire. Like, let's get you in here and get the nail out of your arm, you know? But, yeah, pretty much got the tackle box out of his truck and got some vice grips on it and just ripped the thing out.
And he never flinched. And I just thought, man, this is a different kind of toughness than I've ever seen in my entire life.
You knew you were among men.
Absolutely.
In the boatyard.
Absolutely.
Well, he was the bottom job expert at the boatyard, David was. So.
It takes a village to make a boatyard run.
But, you know, the boatyard wasn't very prestigious work, you know. I mean, it's kind of lowball stuff. But anyway, it turned out some really good guys. It turned David out, yeah. Turned Gator out. One of the major contractors here in Gulf Shores is a house builder, builds real high dollar houses. He worked at the boatyard. Another boy who's multimillionaire now. He worked at the boatyard. We turned out some pretty good boys, you know, from the boatyard. And so I guess life experiences at the boatyard started them out on the right foot anyway.
I agree with that.
A few of them stay at Angola, you know, too, over there.
We have another arena of opportunity to share stories in. David, he's the pastor here at Oyster Bay Baptist Church now, but this is not the first thing you did out of college. You have a long history in football, and man, we love some good football stories. Share some of those with us.
I got some good ones. First off, it's kind of miraculous because Gator and I played on probably the worst football team in the history of the state of Alabama at Gulf Shores. We went 0-10.
That's pretty bad.
We lost to Coffeyville to start. I know it's fun to start our first season, and they're a 1A, and we were a 3A. Like, it was bad. But
it was so bad that I got hurt during the season, and they made me buy a ticket for the rest of the games. Like, that's how bad we were.
Really, really did happen.
It was awful.
So there was a couple guys from that team that ended up being successful coaches, and one of them is a guy named Dustin who graduated with us. He's still coaching in college. And then I decided when I got out of college, I was working in banking. I didn't like counting other people's money and wearing a tie every day. And so I'd always loved playing ball. I was an average player, but wanted to get back into coaching because coaches had a big impact on my life. So I went back to school and started at South Alabama and then started coaching high school. And my goal was to eventually become a head coach. And so after about a decade, I did that. And I should have known the first game that football head coaching was not my thing. So we load up and we go and we played Satsuma. Satsuma had this brand new stadium. I mean, nice field turf. And I'd taken over one of the losingest programs in Alabama high school history. They had like 5 straight losing seasons. We worked all spring, all summer, getting them ready to have what we thought was going to be the first playoff season ever in the history of the school. And so we show up to play Satsuma, and first sign that it wasn't good, my starting left tackle comes up to me and take it I've given them a checklist that has everything they have to put in their bag, cleats, shoulder pads, everything. Like, it's self-explanatory. He comes up to me and says, I forgot my cleats. All I got is these Sperry's to wear in warm-ups. So this is my starting left tackle, the one that I need more than anything. So I'm like, all right, it's not a good start. And so I call somebody at the school. They're bringing his cleats over. He's warming up in Sperry's in front of this big crowd. Then we go back, give him this big pep talk, and we start walking over to run out through the banner and everything. And my best star running back on the team, as we're walking from the locker room to the field, looks at me and goes, Coach, I'm so nervous. And pukes all over my shoes. And it was downhill from there. We got destroyed in that game. It didn't go well.
And you had to coach in pukey shoes?
And had to coach in pukey shoes. So.
What was the score? You remember? Did y'all get beat by a lot?
38-0 Ooh, something like man. That.
So how did you feel about the playoff bid after the first game?
I didn't feel as confident as I did initially, but I still felt like there was some hope, and we bounced back, man. Those were a bunch of good, resilient kids, and we ended up winning, I think, four games that year, three games the following year. I was very proud of them, man. They overcame those nerves eventually. So
my dad was a high school football coach, and I'm going to try to say this without getting misty. When he had cancer and I was in his hospital room with him, those players came by. I'm talking about guys that are CEOs and grandfathers and grown men. They call him Coach. Not Gary, not his nickname, but Coach. Because he had such a great influence in their life. Coaching is a big, big thing. And you can have a great influence, a very positive influence. My dad did. I'm sure you did too.
My dad always told me that coaching and preaching weren't far away from one another. And I think that's a very accurate statement. Like, I was always conflicted for a while about spending so much time away from my family and raising other people's kids and not necessarily being available for my wife and my kids. But I think you're right. Those guys.
It's a family commitment.
Yeah. As crazy and as bad as it was sometimes, those guys still call me and they still call me Coach. You're gonna make me. But when something happens important in their life, usually one of the first ones they reach out to. So it's a special bond, and it's a good platform to minister from, too.
And you always have a something if you lead somebody in the right direction.
Amen to that.
That's right.
Well, I got a couple more. I got another one. So same school I was at. We're deeper in the season this time, and we're going to play a team up in Evergreen, Alabama. And they're good. They got players all over the place. They either won the state championship the year before or got to the state championship. And looks likely they're probably going to do it again. So we get up there, and our kids are pretty intimidated because this is a different place than it is down in West Mobile where we were coming from, and big kids, athletic kids. Well, we get in the locker room before the game, and the visitors' locker room is kind of attached to their locker room, and you can hear their music blaring in there, and our kids are kind of getting intimidated. Well, here comes this star D lineman for them. Dude, he's 6'5 plus, 320 plus, huge. He's got his headphones on, and he's got 100-pound dumbbells in each hand. And he comes walking into our locker room and goes straight into the bathroom stall that has no door on it. Sits down on the commode, just staring at our kids, curling these dumbbells. Does his business, continues to curl the dumbbells, and walks straight out right back into the home locker room. And needless to say, that one was about the same score as the previous one that we talked about. So that exponentially increase their fear and anxiety and all those things. I got one last football story. So I got to coach the last 8 years before I came to Oyster Bay with the guy who is considered kind of the Bear Bryant of Alabama high school football, the winningest coach in history. And he just retired, so I think it's safe for me to tell this story. But Terry Curtis was the coach at UMS. My dad actually, his first job in the ministry was for Terry Curtis's dad, QT Curtis, over at Sage Avenue in Mobile. So I got a job with Terry when I left that head coaching job. And they were in the midst of an epic run. So I plugged in at the right time, and we didn't lose a game for 3 years, and we won three straight state championships, and it was amazing. Well, we played in state championship game in Auburn, in Jordan-Hare, and we were playing Deschler. And Deschler had this young, hotshot coach. They were pretty good. We knew we'd probably beat them. I mean, that's how it usually happened in the playoffs. You'd watch these teams from up in parts of North Alabama, and you knew, like, they hadn't played the competition that we did. We probably going to handle them. So, well, this young coach did not feel that way. He spouted off a little bit in the week leading up to the game, and there'd been some words. Curtis kind of stayed quiet, and so we get in the game, and I'm talking, we are mollywhopping this team. I'm talking, it's like 40-something to nothing, and this is in the start of the fourth quarter. We ended up winning like 52-3, I think, or 52 to nothing. So I go to Coach Curtis, and we're up by 40 points. I said, hey, you ready to put the twos in? I said, nope. I'm going to teach this boy how to respect his elders. And so we left him in and tagged another couple on the total. So
he learned a valuable lesson.
He did.
Gator, I feel like that as many stories as you told me yesterday, you've bound to have another one. Let's hear that.
Well, this story about life lessons kind of reminded me of when I played a little ball in Montgomery baseball, and my first year there, I was just nervous as can be. They had a freshman team, you know, so I'm on the freshman team, and I'm with the big boys, and you know, I'm trying my best, and you know, just trying to soak it up, you know. But just I mean, my eyes are this big around, you know, everything I'm doing, and some of these guys, you know, they got kids and stuff, you know. I mean, they're older big guys, you know. So I remember every other game or so, they'd let a couple of the young guys just sit in with the big boys, you know. So I got to sit with the varsity guys one game, and man, I was so pumped up, so excited. Gave me a nice uniform, not the hand-me-down with rags in it and everything. And I'm just sitting there. I'm like, man, this is it. This is real deal. Even though this little school, you know, it's not that big, but to me, it was awesome. So I'm sitting there just soaking it up with these guys, and our third base coach at the time was named Brack. He's just this bowling ball, muscular, huge guy, intimidating. And he didn't say a whole bunch most of the time, you know, just kind of a quiet guy. And anyway, the game's going on, the guys are all loose, and they're, you know, they're joking around one another and everything. And I'm kind of getting in the vibe too. And anyway, this one of our guys, Ratch, he gets up there to bat, and he strikes out. And he turns around and he flips the bat towards dugout, and it kind of takes a bad bounce, goes in the dugout, and goes right past Brack's head. Brack comes out of the dugout, and he says, timeout, which I didn't, you know, I think we were out of timeout. I didn't know we had timeouts in baseball, but it was timeout. Now, everybody on the field is like, what's going on? He points to the right fielder on their team and says, slide aside. The right fielder's like, what? So he runs over a little bit, you know, like, what is he doing? He takes that bat and hurls it into right field, as far as I've ever seen a bat slung in my entire life. And he looks at Ratch, says, go get it. And I mean, it's like, this is a pretty big game. There's people, I mean, the umpires are like, what is going on? Ratch runs out there, he gets it, he comes back, give me the bat. Whew, he throws it out there again. Proceeds to do this about three or four times, making him go get it. He goes and gets the bat finally. He comes back in there. He goes, now go sit down. The next guy strikes out, It was a miracle. He runs in there, takes his helmet off, shines it up, sets it on the thing, puts his bat down. He looks down at me, and I was like, I didn't move the rest of the game. I'm not getting out of line, nothing. But learned my lesson real quick on that.
The best is when you can learn lessons through others' pain. And it sounds like that you did that.
I definitely did. Those guys were on their P's and Q's though, the rest of the season.
Man, I would love to have been in the stands on that one.
I got a pretty good one on the pain of others. We were talking earlier about coaching against Reuben Foster, probably one of the biggest, baddest dudes to ever play high school football, play for the University of Alabama, now in the NFL, I guess. So we played him in the playoffs when I was at McGill, and we'd watch film on them, and this dude was shot out of a cannon, would destroy you. So as we're looking at film, people are running out of the way and letting him just go down and kill the guy returning the kickoff. So I decided we're going to set him up. Like opening kickoff of this playoff game, we're going to run, we called it guillotine, and I had like a sign for it, like chop off with his head. And so we're going to make him think we're parting the Red Sea like everybody else. And then I'm going to send this ninth grader who was a trained assassin. They called him Mega Man. All right. I mean, and he was the baddest dude, not in the ninth grade, like in the whole school. So we're going to let him go, and I'm going to bring this dude from the far outside and ear hole Reuben Foster. And we're going to start this game off right. So we call guillotine, opening kickoff, and they kick it. Here comes Reuben Foster, 100 miles an hour. Sets up perfectly. The C parts, here comes Mega Man, crown of his hat right in his ear hole. Boom. Mega Man out for the game. Reuben Foster pops back up, plays the rest of the game. Actually, they won in double overtime, Q sweep with Reuben Foster as the lead blocker. So did not work out the way we had planned.
Mega Man down.
Yep.
You had a good plan.
It was a great plan.
And sometimes good plans don't work out.
Yep. Not against superhumans like that.
I loved watching him play at Alabama. Loved watching him play. You hit hard when you hit so hard that you can't even use your shoulder. Or what? Wasn't it his shoulder that kept going out because he hit it, people so hard with it that it just couldn't withhold all the force? It was amazing to watch him play. And he's in the big now.
He was playing in the NFL. I don't know if he's still in there. But his thing, he was so big and strong, but so fast at the same time and so violent. Like we had a quarterback on that team, Jason Smith, who played at Auburn, and I think he's playing in Japan. Last time I talked to him, he was one of the fastest kids in the state, and Reuben Foster ran him down like nothing.
Wasn't Reuben the one that got an Auburn tattoo?
Yes.
And then,
then went to Alabama. And
then played for the Tide.
I ain't saying nothing to him about it, though.
Neither. No. I wouldn't bring it up.
Let's do this real quick. We have to clear the air. Robin, a couple of episodes ago, recorded at the Shedio and had a tint on his fingers. And many people have picked up on the tint that was on his fingers, and they've hypothesized from Cheetos, Doritos, and they wanted to know what was it. So I want to take this opportunity and let Robin tell the story of why his fingers were tinted as they were.
I ain't proud of this, but I take medicine. I keep it in these little medicine containers. But my wife was gone for a few days, and I was in charge of washing clothes. My wife always goes through my pockets and get my pocket knife and my medicine out. I washed and dried my medicine. And I take a pill called Enactapone, I think. But it's...
He pronounces it like I do.
It's made out of oranges, I think. But to my pill bottle, after it got washed and dried, all them pills got dissolved into one. And then when it dried, it baked them like a cookie. Look, that medicine's high. I didn't want to throw it away. So I scooped it out of there with my finger to take my daily dose. And that's what the orange was on my finger. It's just no redneck trying to get by.
What was the name of that prescription again?
Enactapone.
Gotcha.
I take that one.
Y'all pronounce medicines just alike.
Yeah, I do too.
It's similar to Chapatoulas, as you said, that street was called. And, well, we had many Louisiana, New Orleans residents weigh in on exactly how to spell and say Chapatoulas. I can't say it either, but.
It's
Chapatoulas. Right, well, let's get it one more time.
It is Chapatoulas.
Dad used to pronounce, we used to watch the Braves all the time. He used to, remember Andres Galarraga? He used to, it was Gagaraga.
Oh, Gagaraga.
Gagaraga. He loved Gagaraga. And the other one he would say all the time, they had these commercials. I think it was like Jerry Lewis or something with his Jerry's kids, you know. And one night Dad said, I feel so bad for those poor little kids with muscular dystrophy. I said,
muscular.
Dad, I don't think that's what they got.
Yeah, not exactly what they got.
I don't know what that is, but.
So I'm not real bad at mispronouncing words, but I'm not the best speller. Like I lost the third grade spelling bee on window pane. But it came back to bite me in a bad way my first couple months here. I'm up there preaching and I had a slide that had something to do, I can't even remember what it was, self-assess, something like along those lines. And
this was like your third sermon, wasn't it?
Third or fourth. I mean, it was early on. It was pretty fresh. And I got down and had a bunch of texts on my phone. And I could see my brother and Logan run the sound booth. I could see them kind of causing a ruckus up in the sound booth. Well, I had misspelled the word assess, and it was up on the screens. It was online because there were several people from out of town that phoned in to say that I had misspelled it. And it was, it's a word that's in the Bible, but it's obviously on a G-rated podcast.
It was at a spot on the slide too that it really,
yeah,
really
it was like the bold. It was like the banner up top. The bold. I mean, and it was.
I'm afraid you abbreviated the same way I abbreviated the Baptist Association.
Yep.
One time.
Yep. Pretty much. Pretty much.
What we have to know is, what is the moral of the story? What have you done differently?
I have an associate pastor who has the spiritual gift of proofreading, and so therefore I pass it on to him. And he does it on a weekly basis, either him or Felicia, our secretary, and they cover me.
No final slides happen until it goes through.
That's right.
That's a good
thing. If he didn't proofread here recently, we would have been praying for the Hopi spirit to come. So thank goodness he's there.
Is that different? That's a different.
It's a little different.
You had one more, didn't you, Gator?
Well, we were talking about this a while ago, and it just reminded me of these funny voices and stuff. We had this guy, y'all remember R.D. Mercer and Crank Gangers? This guy, this guy was the prank call specialist in the college years. His name was Judd. So whenever we'd get all guys together, he was always calling somewhere and just messing with them. Well, one night he calls the biggest grocery store in Montgomery, and he gets in touch with the manager, and he says, and he had this funny voice that he did, and I can't do it great, so just have to bear with me. But he was like, your Snicker bars don't taste good. And the manager's like, well, you know, I'm sorry about that. Bring them up here. And he said, well, I'm eating them now, and they don't taste good. And he said, well, you bring them back up here. And he said, I'm going to try your chips right here. And he opened, you can hear him opening a bag of chips. And the guy's like, are you here at the store, sir? And he said, I'm trying your chips. Your chips are stale. He said, I'm going to go. So he's going through all this stuff. And the guy's like, sir, you can't be opening stuff in our store and eating them right now, you know? So he goes, well, I'm going to go over here and try something else. So he's, you know, naming all this stuff off. Well, the manager finally, he's like, you can hear him in the background. He's got it on speaker. He's like, we got to go find this guy. He's opening stuff all through the store. So he's like, I'm over here. Pringles are terrible. Pringles are not good. So they send him. They said, you can hear him. Go, go, go. He's down the chip aisle. So they go to the chip aisle. And he's like, oh, are you looking for me? And he said, yes, sir, you can't be doing that. And he's like, oh, I love hide and seek. I love hide and seek. So he goes, I'm passing the meat. And he's like, oh, hey, go. You know, he's down there. He's like, I can see crawfish. I can see, you know, he's naming all this. It's like, you can hear the manager. He's, you know, he's this way, that way. So finally, this manager is, I can only imagine there's employees sprinting all through this grocery store creating looking for somebody who's not there.
I'm seeing a SWAT operation.
Yeah, creating a perimeter around us.
So the phone call ends with him going, I'm taking a bite out of apple. And you hear him go, he's in produce. Y'all, everybody to produce. And all of a sudden you hear this guy go, if your employee don't get his hands off of me, I'm about to dot his eye. We're like, okay, that's enough of that story. So there was some employee grabbed some random guy who was on the phone, I'm guessing, and almost got beat up in the produce section trying to buy some apples.
That is incredible. So you can't have good thoughts when you're in college, because that's brilliant for real.
Oh, we had some fun for sure.
That's awesome.
He didn't pass many courses, but he had a lot of fun.
That's important. I mean, the fun is also important, but
life
it is
experience.
Important.
A lot of money went down the tube, though.
Especially if you were paying. If you're paying, that's really important that he passes the course.
Took volleyball one semester, and I did pretty good in that.
A? Bad. A in volleyball?
I think it was a pass-fail.
Oh, okay.
But I passed.
I think we would be amiss being down here, Bond Secure, Gulf Shores, down here on the coast, to not tell a few stories to allow people inside the community. So, Mr. Nelson, you said that you had some good ones about the community to tell us.
Well, this is a very old community and very, you know, all of our parents and when I was born and raised here. But anyway, about 20-some years ago, a lot of this land sold and was going to be built condos on it. So anyway, some of it was Indian sites. So they had to get some archaeologists to come over here from Alabama and do some studies, you know. So anyway, they're down here and they digging around and they found 27 bodies and Indian bodies. And they found one body that they're not sure what it was. They said it was only buried about 7-8 inches deep, so they figured it was some foul play with it. But anyway.
My kin folks could have been gangsters back in the day. We don't know.
They were not angels by any means. But anyway, so I got talking. I like old history, so I was talking to this archaeologist about it. You know, and he was talking about poor Indians here had to eat oysters, you know. And he said, man, they like to starve to death. And he said, you know, they had a terrible life, you know, mosquitoes and everything. And then I said, have you lost your mind? I said, the Indians that lived here were fat and sassy. I said, there was oysters, there was fish, there was shrimp. I said, there was, you know, life was pleasant. I mean, you know, plenty of animals. And besides mosquitoes, we didn't have any mosquitoes here. I said, no, we had mosquitoes, but in the development of the land, we've, you know, built roads and made ponds and stuff to make the mosquito a lot worse than what they were when we were kids. When we were kids, they put us out of the house at daylight. We come back in after sunset, you know, or stayed out fishing all night. We didn't have no mosquito repellent or anything, you know. If the mosquitoes were if they were then like they are now, you know, you couldn't have stood it. But anyway, it's crazy. You know, this guy has got a college education. That's supposed to be his, you know, his specialty, you know. And I don't think he was very right.
Didn't they find like a mound of oyster shells?
Oh, yeah. It's built. Yeah. So they right here back in the church. There's one pile there.
Yeah, but the guy went on down and he was telling us about how, you know, all where everything was and like where they did the fishing, where they did this. And he said, you could tell over here, this is where they did their oysters, you know. And he said, we dug down, we found a big mound of these oysters and stuff. And I'm sitting there looking and he's going on and on about these oyster mounds, yeah, you know, and whatnot. And I look over at Dad, and Dad looks at it, he goes, that's where Uncle Hoopy used to dump all of his oysters. What are you talking about? He had a fish house right there.
And Uncle Hoopy was not a Native American.
No. Uncle Hoopy was not. But the look on this archaeologist's face was just like, ah.
Uncle Hoopy had nothing to do with the Mesopotamian period.
No, he did not.
Years ago, when I was a kid, my dad and I had a cousin of ours that shrimped with us. And his name was Ed Lorenza. And Cousin Ed was long-legged, you know. And so when he squatted, his tail would almost touch the floor, you know, how some people do. I never could squat like that. But anyway, and he wore these old carpenter breeches, fit real loose. Well, Cousin Ed hated crabs worse than anything. And so we had these sticks, you know, we picked, you know, right through the fish and stuff with. So every time Cousin Ed would come to a crab, he'd hit it with a stick, you know. Well, Cousin Ed hit this one old she crab with a stick, you know, and about half killed her. And anyway, he's picking shrimp, and all of a sudden he just kind of lays back in the fish and the shrimp behind him, and he goes, "Oh, Jimmy, I'm right, Jimmy. Oh, Jimmy. And we like think he's having a heart attack or something, and we like, "What's wrong, Ed?" Oh, I'm burnt. Ed, are you okay? What's wrong? This crab had came around behind him and got him through the private.
Oh.
And he's laying there, and all these fish, catfish, crabs, everything's laid flat out on his back, just screaming all. So anyway, after several minutes, he kind of regained consciousness, and it had drawn blood. And anyway, after a few minutes, you know, I say a few minutes, probably 15 or 20 minutes, he was able to get around. Cousin Ed takes his pick stick, and for maybe a week or two, every crab he came to, he had smashed that crab to smithereens and go, "You ain't the one, but you might be his brother, cousin, uncle, or aunt."
Vengeance is his.
Vengeance was his.
We're getting kind of deep in the show, but I think we got time for two more. David's got one. Gator Man's got one. So I'm going to let y'all fight over who goes first.
Let me start, and then you finish off with that.
Go for it.
So I was playing baseball in high school, and I remember we were playing BC Rain, and they had this guy, little Samson guy was his name, and he was slinging it close to 90. He was, which probably not fast for the kids nowadays, but that was humming it back then. And, man, it was a close game, and I'm getting right up on the plate. And a guy sails one up, and it hits me right in the jaw. I mean, I blacked. I don't remember anything. But my whole family was there. I mean, apparently I was running around hollering and yelling, embarrassing myself. It was not the best moment for me.
But, spitting blood everywhere.
We got to the doctor, and he gets these 9 stitches in there. So get home, and this thing just starts swelling, and it gets bigger and bigger. Well, it hadn't even dawned on me, but prom is the next day. And I had been trying to go with this girl for so long from Foley. I mean, I was so excited about it and everything. Well, I'm like, I'll ice it real good. It'll go down surely. You know? Well, the next day, it's twice as big. This thing is like a goiter. I mean, it is huge. My eyes half black. So I go and I knock on the door, and I got my suit on and everything, you know, trying to like turn where it doesn't look that bad. Anyway, her dad opens the door, and he's a big old guy. He just instantly starts dying laughing. And he said, "Son, I was going to give you a long talk about tonight, but y'all just go and have as much fun as you think you can, all right?"
Safe. She's safe with you tonight.
She's safe. Yeah, nothing was going to happen that night. Not with my tumor out there.
Golly. So we had a guest join us. So we want to welcome Shane. On time is not his strong suit anyway. Has never been, but this is maybe as fashionably late as you've ever been. Let me rearrange this microphone. Well, but this is a bad situation anyway.
Why? What's happened?
Because, well, nothing's happened. Robin has been trying to pop my back all morning. It's the most awkward thing that I've been a part of. He woke up that way.
He was ready to pop your back.
We've got it on camera. Josh filmed basically a wrestling match with me trying to get him away from me earlier today. But tell everybody why you just showed up.
Philip didn't tell me what time we were recording.
You in a church. he didn't tell me
what time we recorded until I was too late to get here. That was the problem. So you did tell me what time we were recording.
We're in the fellowship hall.
Oh yeah, we're in the fellowship hall. That's right.
Church. You know what the Bible says? Liars. They go where?
The church to hear more about Jesus.
Well, maybe you're in the right place.
A man that lied to you, steal from you.
That's what I've always heard, too.
You ever heard somebody say that they'd rather climb up a power pole and tell you a lie than they had to stand flat-footed and tell you the truth?
That's you.
That's not me. That's not me, but I've heard that.
You're identifying yourself very well.
I'm just glad I got to hear about the prom date. That sounded like a fantastic night.
Toss that thing back over there. David's got one more.
Yeah. Go ahead. Finish this off since I spoiled it.
That is a perfect intro because the last story I got is about – probably the biggest liar that we've ever, and you know, you always got a friend that is, I guess you'd call him the fibber or the liar or whatever, the tall tale guy.
It wasn't so much he was a liar.
We call him Marty.
Marty?
Long story. We ain't got time for that.
This guy just really, really liked to stretch the truth. Like, he could take a little bit of something and run a mile with it.
He was an embellisher, for sure. So me and Gator have known each other since we're in elementary school. We stayed connected. He went to college in Montgomery. I went to college in Tuscaloosa, and he would drive over every weekend. And we'd hang out, go to the Alabama game. And so our other buddy lived two houses down from me, and he was the one, the tall tale guy. Like, so me and Gator up there one weekend, and we find a dead bird outside the back of our house. And we decided we're going to set him up because we know if we put – this bird over there anywhere remotely close to, he's going to come up with some kind of story. So we take this little bird and we put him on his back stoop behind his back door, and it don't take 10 minutes. Doom, 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 doom on our back door. And he said, guys, you'll never guess.
We had to sit down for him to start this story because he was like,
you'll never believe what just happened. You'll never believe it. And we're trying to keep our composure because we know it's going some direction.
The truth is he walks outside and just sees a dead bird.
Laying on his doorstep.
That's the truth. And this is where it goes.
So he comes, we sit down. He said, man, this little bird was flying down by the back door. I picked up a rock and I hummed that thing, hit him right in the head. And killed him dead. And so we're trying to keep our composure. And
he went on and on too, though. I go over there and he was still flirting around. And then I had to pick up another rock and I slung it again. I mean, he's going on and on and on.
Like he always did. So we let him go on with this story for about 10 minutes or so. And then finally we tell him, dude, we found that bird dead and put it on your doorstep. And the look... like, he turns as white as Jimmy's shirt.
And then instantly goes, yeah, I know y'all did. I just want to tell y'all a good story.
I'm just playing. I'm just kidding, sure y'all. Did. Yeah. Yeah, I think most communities, if they were honest, has at least one of those people.
Yep.
Some shows have at least three.
Before I go to scripture time, I think it's only fair that I share the truth of what has happened. You knew 2 months ago that we were going to do this at this time, at this location. And I called you last night and I was like, hey, man, we're going to record in the morning. You know, are you going to come on down tonight? And you're like, I don't know if I'm going to come. I'm going to leave at 5 a.m. and I'm going to get down there. By my watch, if you had left at 5 a.m. this morning, you would have been here on time to record.
Well, I was also told that y'all were going to go fishing with us yesterday, too. So,
you know, we are at the beach, and Jimmy Buffett said, it was 5 o'clock somewhere.
He's dead now, though.
Jimmy's no longer with us. We still have his songs. We don't have that. Well, let's jump into scripture time.
Let's go.
Sounds like you need it. Matthew 5, verses 5 through 7. We're on the Sermon on the Mount, so these are the Beatitudes. The meek and lowly are fortunate, for the whole wide world belongs to them. Happy are those who long to be just and good, for they shall be completely satisfied. Happy are the kind and the merciful, for they shall be shown mercy. All of these are really good, but we don't have time to go into each and every one of them. But I want to center in on verse 7. So happy are, or blessed be, the kind and the merciful. So this morning, when you were trying to fight me in the condo, what I told Josh is I said, I can't really win this, even if I whip Robin like a stray dog that has come up on my back porch, I'm not gonna win. And I wouldn't have been happy if I would have whipped you that, you know, this morning. So that's why this has been on my heart that I want to be happy.
And humble.
And what is it? Sympathetic. And I want to be, so I showed you mercy this morning. How did it feel being a recipient of the mercy?
I'm at a loss for words. Let me say something serious about the scripture. What that scripture ain't saying is, it's not saying act like a wimp. Christians aren't necessarily wimp. You talk about hard work. Christians are supposed to work hard. Talking about taking care of your family. We're supposed to take care of family. We're not supposed to lay down and be mealy mouthed and limp wristed and let the world run over us. We got to have a backbone. We got to be strong. We got to act like men. And this scripture is saying that, but so misunderstood.
Well, since we're serious now, let me add the other serious element of the scripture. I'm not by nature a merciful person. My flesh does not want to show mercy, and I think that that's probably a large majority of people. We want justice, and we want the justice that we feel like that is deserved. Here's one thing. If you are like me, a confessed struggler to give mercy to other people, here's something I want you to think about. If you're a Christian, if you're not a Christian, well, that's a whole other story, but this is for Christians. If you're a Christian and you have trouble showing mercy to other people, one thing I just want you to think about is that you have received the most mercy that you can receive in life, because you were a disbeliever of God, you were unrepentant, walking away from Him, you chose to do things that He told you not to do, and even in spite of all those things, He gave you mercy and forgave you of disbelieving, of all the sin that you've done, and sacrificed His Son even to the highest level, so that you could have that mercy. So the next time, just like I was able to show you mercy, the next time that you are put in a position to show mercy to somebody, think about the immense amount of mercy that God has shown you, and allow that to be a motivator to give mercy to somebody who doesn't even deserve it. Because guess what? I didn't deserve it either. You didn't deserve it either.
1 Corinthians 13:5, the love chapter, says, love keeps no record of wrongs. Mm. Men, you want to revitalize your marriage? You want to renew your relationship with your children? Stop keeping a record of wrongs.
Well, I love what Robin said, because the Lord's been working on me in regards to the meekness mentioned in that passage. And I think a lot of times when we see meekness, we think about being humble or a guy who just lays down and doesn't. But I think bringing the two things together, mercy and meekness, it's like Robin said, we're not called to be weak and not manly. We're called to be men like God commissions us to. And so the best definition I've heard of meekness is power under control. So you have the ability to do certain things, to keep a record of wrong, to impose your will, to be unmerciful. But as a man of God, God has shown us mercy. So therefore, we, exert power under control. It's intentional restraint and not giving into your flesh and being kind even when you don't want to, even when the kids and the wife and everybody else are driving you crazy. You restrain, you hold back, you keep your power under control, and you give mercy as we've been given mercy.
Amen.
And you got to look, you know, our perfect example is there's Christ, right? Because you see that perfect restraint that he had in the last days when he was being tried and being accused of all these things and tortured and beat. He had the power, if he would have wanted to call 10,000 angels and end it all there, but he didn't. He restrained himself. He remained humble, remained focused on what he had to accomplish. And that's a perfect example of what every Christian has to do. You've got to understand what your purpose is, understand the direction that you've got to go. And although you're being ridiculed, you're being tempted on every hand by the devil and his angels, you've got to realize what your purpose is and stay in control, stay focused on what you're supposed to do. And that didn't make you weak, like you said, but it does make you humble and it makes you merciful, knowing that, hey, there's a different way I could approach this, but I'm not, because of the example that I've been given.
Amen.